another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host and friend, Steve Montgomery, author of The Converging Apostasy and A Quick Outline of Hands-on Eschatology, A Matter of Timing and Agency. Steve, I feel like it's been over a year, and maybe it has been over a year. It's been forever since you and I spoke, but you hit me up with this topic today, and I'll be honest, I don't think too many people have really gone deep with this, and it is important. I noticed whenever I left Branhamism and went into some of the modern churches, denominational churches, I noticed that there were certain things, there were certain aspects that I could see just so similar. And I've, as anything, I study to no end. So I'm studying these trails of doctrine. Where do they come from? And you can trace some of these threads all the way back to revival, the revival that Branham and others were in. And I got to scratching my head thinking, well, this can't be. Why would they adopt this? Now that I'm looking at all of these different groups that are in the New Apostolic Reformation, I'm starting to notice that as a whole, this group of apostolic networks is invading the churches. And like I said, I don't know that anybody has tried to tackle this, but I'm interested to hear what you say about this, because it is fascinating and scary all at the same time.
Yeah, John, it has been a long time since we've got together. Through my attending one of these, what you would call normal, non-charismatic denominational churches, I have seen some what I think of as just like NAR incursions and little bitty things sometimes that you could say innocently being introduced. Other times it looks like there's a rhyme and a reason, like things are being prepped and there's some negative forces behind these preps. So what I'm thinking here, this may seem like an obvious question, but I have in front of me here, does the NAR have an interest in non-charismatic denominational churches? The answer is yes. So let's maybe take a look at some of that and then stop, and I'm sure you'll have a lot to say about it. So this church I was attending during the Sunday school class, there's a presentation. It's called Seedbed. And, so it's introduced informally as a supplemental Sunday school Bible study group presentation. So I'm like you, John. I like to look up things and find out, is there a rhyme or reason to the way this thing is being produced? Oh, there's something not in my notes, and I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but the way the presenter, well, she looked kind of glassy-eyed to me, kind of in a state of reverie, maybe, which I couldn't say is a bad thing. But she had a way of pronouncing Jesus. Okay, for most of us, it's Jesus. For her, it was Jesus. And I have heard that in mostly charismatic circles. So I said, okay, again, no huge crime, but it just kind of perked up my ears. And so since my ears were already perked up and I wanted to find out more about the group, I found in 2023 post at the Seedbed website, and lo and behold, it gave a very favorable account of John Wimber, the founder of Vineyard Movement, which, as many of your listeners would know, began in the 1980s and went by such names as the Third Wave. Well, then we find out that the Third Wave was a term coined by the NAR apostle, Peter Wagner. And so, again, like I said, it really perked up my ears and made me wonder what's going on here. How deep does this run? But it just reminded me of something that we're both aware of, is that the NAR and this Third Wave have easily been seen to make claims of signs and wonders performed by so-called modern-day apostles and prophets who believe that God is speaking directly through.
Like I said, it's just so fascinating to me. I'm digging deep, and you don't know this. I've been doing this kind of by myself and with a few other hosts. We've been looking into, digging into the research of the epicenter whenever the Pentecostal movement started to explode into what became charismatic, which obviously is going to include Chuck Smith, John Wimber, some of the names you're mentioning, and trying to identify, is there a clear trail of history? And what I'm finding is it's very convoluted. There isn't really a clear trail. What I instead see are so many weird connections, like Lonnie Frisbee, who is staying in the apartment of one of the shepherding leaders. And you can't make this stuff up. It's like all of these web of connections. The shepherding movement was spearheaded by five figures, one of which was William Branham's partner and campaign manager, Ernie Baxter. So you've got all of these webs of connections. And the problem is, so shepherding movement, it spiraled out of control and it became exposed as authoritarian. And it was making a big disruption in charismatic Christianity. And I've got, I don't know if I've shared this with you, I've got some magazines from the shepherding that promoted the shepherding movement after it had pretty well been exposed. John Wimber is trying to bring everybody back together in unity. And so you've got the Wimber aspect, you've got the shepherding aspect, and you've got so many other streams coming into this. Well, if you take a step back from a denominational standpoint, you have lots of Christians who are in denominational churches who are also reading some of these Christian magazines and subscribing to the, you know, Christian radio stations, Christian publications, books, etc. And they don't really have a clear distinction between what came from this revival mess and what is true Christianity. So some of it just kind of bleeds in. I don't know that there's any hidden agenda, but you see this cross-pollination of ideas that some of them are coming into the church. Some of them are good, I'm not going to lie, but some of them are just, you know, I have to question whether some of the ideas are actually Christian ideas that are seeping in, but yet it's mainstream Christianity.
Yeah, and as we talk about John Wimber, something flashes through my mind that does go back to the latter rain, and that is his promotion of Franklin Hall, one of the more strange prophets of that movement. And so, of course, his big emphasis was on atomic power through prayer, and that was a predecessor to the latter rain movement by just a couple of years, 46.
Atomic power by God through fasting and prayer.
Fasting and prayer. This is it. Yeah, and anybody who's read the accounts of the latter rain when it first began up in Saskatchewan at North Battleford, you had this idea that people had already been fasting up to 30 days, supposedly. And so they were really, really in a state of heightened anticipation for something to happen. They were praying for a revival. And then somebody, John, you've got a real knack for hunting things down. I've never heard who this was, but I've heard that there was a young lady who stood up and prophesied to the group, unidentified for me. I haven't found her name. But she said something to the effect of, take off your shoes, for you stand on holy ground. Okay, so that had a big impression on the folks, I guess. But as far as this incursion into denominational churches goes, a church that I've visited pretty regularly and gone to other Sunday school classes had this occurrence. Okay, so the senior pastor at this non-charismatic denominational church implied that travailing prayer had been lost to the denominational churches in America, that denominational churches can't compete with the effectiveness of the churches in Africa, Central America, South America, which thrive in numerical growth and emotional fervor, and that the churches of the third world will likely become what he said centers of pure and engaging Christianity. So I'd heard that kind of talk before, but I thought it was interesting that it was being presented in this setting. Later, the pastor made a casual reference to, here goes, IHOP, I think he called it the International House of Prayer, because there was the pastor very informally said that, confessed that, you know, sometimes I just don't know how to pray. And so then he made this reference to IHOP. And he also made a reference not only to me personally, because I asked him by way of email. He made a reference to Mike Bickle and to Alan Hood, one of Bickle's long-term associates. When I asked him about this, he did become a bit defensive and responded that he had not been duped by the NAR, once I explained what that was, and that the official position that he held was a millennial, which kind of doesn't fit some of the stuff you hear in the NAR about taking dominion and the seven mountains. He also said, this is a familiar idea, he said that challenging anyone in a position of church leadership was a serious matter. And of course, we've heard that touch not thine anointed idea.
I think I mentioned one of the first churches that we attended, which was a mainstream denominational church. They were taking the position that the apostles were a governing figure, not somebody who was sent out, somebody who was a messenger, the biblical term for apostle. They really saw it as a church authority. And at the time, I'm literally new to everything, because I had left the cult, I'd left that mindset, and I just kind of wiped my slate clean, and I said, teach me, I want to learn. Well, they're teaching me this authoritarian structure of church governance, and something just didn't sit right. I didn't really understand yet how bad it was, but whenever I began to understand that the fivefold ministry concept that came out of Latter Rain was invading the churches, and yes, they may not have adopted the full fivefold ministry, they did adopt some of the authoritarian ideas that came from it. And so I got into a bit of a discussion with one of the ministers, trying to get him to explain why an authoritarian structure was needed if we had the Holy Spirit. And I'll never forget the look on the face, because as a Christian minister, you really can't answer that question. If God's governing, why do I need to govern the people? And so it turned into this weird conversation that I'll never forget and I'll never understand. But that conversation is actually what led me into digging deeper into the authoritarian ideas that were coming out of Branhamism, and then to think that it created a whole movement. The shepherding movement was literally an authoritarian structure based off of this, and the cult's idea was an authoritarian idea. To think that evaded, you know, all of the Christian governance that could have applied to it, somehow they skirted around it, and that it laid the groundwork for what literally became the New Apostolic Reformation. That was the prototype for the apostolic governance.
Yeah, and when you talk about authoritarian, what I'm hearing in my head is anybody, you know, consider this a red flag when they talk about I'm under the covering of such and such minister, prophet, apostle, whoever they think they are. And that would be the thing where, if you're not under somebody's covering, meaning leadership, meaning authoritarian structure, then you're really not in God's perfect will. And so these sorts of churches, or the NAR especially, will offer that form of covering for any individual that wants it, and those who don't want it too. So later I met with this new leader we had at this church, and she was pretty much in charge of prayer initiatives that happened at the church. She had kind of a new position that had been opened up. And she had just led the congregation in what she called a focused prayer reading of scripture. And this is what caught me when she said this. She instructed everyone to close their eyes, take long, slow breaths, let your muscles relax, breathe in the Holy Spirit. Interesting. And then we were told to empty our minds with the expectation that we would hear from the actual voice of God. Okay, so that was very interesting. And so I met her after the service, and I learned that she attended a house church that was affiliated with the NAR prophet Mike Bickle's IHOP. Then you know, just being in the right spot at the right time to learn some of this stuff. I asked her if she was aware, I just kind of threw this one out a little dart and see where it stuck. Asked her if she was aware of the latter reigning prophet Bill Britton or his seminal hints on eschatology that he wrote in one of his main books, Jesus the Pattern Son. She very cheerfully said yes, like she wasn't faking, she knew about that, which again talks about connections, like you're saying, spiderwebs. She's in a position of leadership, in a position to introduce new ideas in a, even a non-charismatic church. She's affiliated with IHOP, and she knows straight up Manifest Sons of God teacher Bill Britton in his book, Jesus the Pattern Son. And of course, being affiliated with the latter rain too, Bill Britton. So that was interesting. So I couldn't talk for a long time then, but I went on to ask her if she knew of George Warnock. And I mentioned to her that he was a leader in the latter rain movement and the author of a very influential book called The Feast of Tabernacles. She again said yes, that she knew of this book. Now, that doesn't prove that she approves of every single doctrine or is totally aware of everything in it, but the fact that she even knew about it was, to me, kind of interesting. So about the same time, I went to the senior pastor's wife, who was in one of the Sunday school classes that I attended, and I asked her about the latter rain and the NAR and told her what I had found out from reading about it. And I mentioned the potentially dangerous prophet, Bill Hammond, in particular. She agreed that Hammond was kind of crazy, but she didn't say that as a critic. So like, oh, you know, that's so Uncle Henry. He says the wildest things. But she went on to say that just like Hammond, she had a prophetic ministry. So it's been a long time since we talked, but just very briefly, Bill Hammond was totally influenced by the latter rain. He was a member of the NAR leadership, and he was another one that really influenced Peter Wagner as far as theology goes. And he was a dyed-in-the-wool Manifest Sons of God teacher, which means dominion, perfection, and what I think of as the sacred purge were all present in his teachings, and included the fact that I interviewed him and he substantiated all that. So soon after this, an associate pastor at the same denominational church told me that he had just returned from a very inspirational conference. And he said that it was spirit-filled and that God was doing a new thing.
And that right there is the key. If you can tell the churches that there's a new thing, new exciting thing, well, everybody's going to look for the new excitement. That's just how it is. And it's sad to me because the Bible talks about those that had the itching ears. But the truth of the matter is, whenever, so when we left, we tried an array of different churches. Some of them were tiny, tiny churches. And I actually felt pretty at home at those. I went to some that were so large, they're nicknamed Six Flags Over Jesus, and they're quite the opposite of the little tiny church. But when you have that large of a church, and I'm not picking on that one in particular, we went to a few large ones, there comes a point where the church itself has to have something of entertainment to keep attracting that many people, because there's a cost in keeping the doors open. If everybody were to decide that, oh, this church over here has a more entertaining service, I can go over there, and the flocks leave, well, now you've got this building with this massive expense, and how do you pay for it? You have to have something entertaining to bring them back. So it's almost like a game of circuses, you know. It turns into a something where you're looking for the excitement. And so for me, it's not a world I'm familiar with. And I don't understand it. I don't understand how a minister would ever want to do that. So I avoid the larger churches for the most part. We sometimes do attend them, but there's just so much problems with that. And the other thing I'll mention, and I don't know how far I'll go with this because I don't want to, I don't want to point out a single individual church in this area, but there are churches who one of the attractions is to bring guest speakers in. And sometimes it may not be for the Sunday service. It may just be men's gathering. It might be some sort of an after. They've got these classes, that kind of thing. One of the churches had a bunch of classrooms in it. Well, some of the speakers, if you're trying to make this an every week thing, every month thing, whatever it is, well, it's not that easy to find speakers, and you can't really vet all of the speakers. So some of those speakers might be talking about IHOP or some of the other names that you've mentioned, and they may not even know themselves. They may not even be aware of the many problems, but somebody now sitting in that room has heard it, and maybe it piqued their interest, and so they go look it up, and what do they find? Oh my gosh, they found the New Apostolic Reformation. Now that spreads into the men's group, and it's like this virus that spreads through the church.
And as you're speaking, the word virus, I'm thinking by this point, you can hear that John and myself are clearly saying that, yes, there is a NAR incursion into non-charismatic denominational churches. And it's really hard to avoid, especially like you're saying, a large church. So what does that come down to? That comes down to NAR networking, which is one of the best ways that they spread their influence to other churches. So there's something here that I would add to that is that the NAR affiliated James Gull, who actually comes across fairly normal. He's not like screaming at you like some of the very fiery prophets will do. He's kind of a low-key fellow. But James Gull, along with Bill Hammond, who I mentioned earlier, is a member of the so-called Apostolic Council of Prophetic Elders. Okay, so there you do have a little, it's kind of loosely fit together, but you have this network that functions through this council. Gull is referred to as a prophet in Harvest Ministries Network, another way of spreading influence. He is under the covering or leadership of the NAR-affiliated Apostle Chae Ahn. And people that have looked into the NAR, they probably heard that name before. So I'm throwing several names at you here, but there's a rhyme and a reason. Then at this church James Gull is considered to be a prophet, that one has a head pastor named Alex Seeley, and his church is called The Belonging. So Seeley is under this supervision, a.k.a. covering of this NAR prophet, James Gull. Then an interesting thing comes around, and this is another way. I mean, you know, John, you know about music as I do. I play gigs, and so music really is, the language that so many people can connect up and find camaraderie, if you want to say it like that. So at the same church, Natalie Green, who's a popular contemporary Christian musical person, she's a recording artist. She leads the worship at Seeley's Belonging. So just to review, you have this James Gull, and he's under the leadership of Chae Ahn. Alex Seeley is the pastor of the NAR-affiliated church called The Belonging. And then Natalie Grant is the worship leader at this church.
So many connections, man. And so the names you're mentioning, Chae Ahn, some of these people are very high-ranking figures in the New Apostolic Reformation. They're not only responsible for the United States, but they're responsible for also governing committees that exist abroad in other countries, etc. And the fact that there's even that type of authoritarian consortium, it really makes you question the entire thing. I can understand having a committee that is, you know, advising churches and giving them some sort of boundaries. That makes sense to me. But the way that they've established it, where you've got an authoritarian hierarchy where the leaders can't be questioned. That's, for me, the real problem here. The leaders are accountable only to the leadership. And some of the names that you're mentioning, I'm not going to, you know, go directly to those, but some of the names you're mentioning are in that chain of command where the rank and file member, say they discover some egregious sin among them, they can't go to the other council and say, hey, look, this guy's got a problem or this girl's got a problem. Instead, the leadership has to follow what was dubbed apparently the Moses model by some of the figures that I'm examining now. And that Moses model just went straight up the chain where the leadership is not accountable to the people. They're accountable only to the other leadership. And as Chuck Smith put it when he said we have the Moses model, he says they're accountable only to God. Well, yes, that sounds good until there's a real problem. You have to have some accountability and some transparency. So this became a pretty big problem, and that was a problem in the 70s and 80s, and it just continues on today.
Yeah, and what you're talking about, the accountability and who's under the covering or leadership of who, that really comes down to what I thought was a very regular group of folks, good people, I would say good Christians, nothing unusual about them. But they looked for supplemental videos and things to open up discussion and Bible study. So in one of these Bible studies at the same church I'm talking about, we saw a lesson that was presented by Christian author Lisa Harper. And at the very end of this lecture she gave as a Bible study, She mentions and has a small interview with the previously mentioned Natalie Grant that's in Alex Seeley's church called Belonging. She's the music minister there. So, okay, I heard this one before. But let's see, you know, you don't want to hop in and immediately cast everybody with, a very negative viewpoint. Let's find out. So in this interview, Grant talked about God's help at a period of personal crisis. Okay, well, that sounds like what a Christian should be talking about, God's help. But then she began to shift the object of her praise and affection away from God, away from Jesus Christ, and repeatedly dropped the buzzwords, his presence, over and over again in her talk with Harper. At the conclusion of this, she said, I fell in love with his presence. Interesting. It sounds subtle. It sounds like being nitpicky, but it's not. And so this is one of those unfortunate side effects of addiction to the Lateran style of praise and worship. Why? Because it produces the so-called produces the presence of God so that you can feel it. And this is euphoric, and it's observable. Anybody who's ever been in a church like this will tell you all about it. Anybody who's been counseled out of one of these churches will tell you all about it, and that's me. I've been there before, and I think, John, you've been there. So this kind of worship is based on experience. It's habit-forming as a way of so-called getting to know the Lord, and it's an invocation-like call for a closer walk. Unfortunately, it ends up becoming an idolatrous form of self-worship, in which it is incumbent upon the worshiper to conjure up or call down the presence. It is a faith based on what is seen, heard, and felt. Through this form of worship, denominational and evangelical churches are exposed to, and I believe corrupted by, a legacy of false and questionable doctrines and practices which cater to the senses, the wallet, and spiritual pride.
And I really don't know how you can not have this type of pride. Whenever you're in a system where the leadership are being presented as the spiritual elite and they're untouchable by the rank and file member, they become heroes and they become part of hero worship. And you have a system where the humans are worshiped maybe not as much as the God, but to a level that's pretty close. You know what I mean? So you have this, you have this hero worship that's spread all around. Well, whoever's in that system of hero worship, it goes to your head. You're going to be filled with pride. And so it's a system that really creates pride. And one of the interesting studies that anybody can do is just read through the New Testament and find how many times pride is mentioned as a sin. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
To continue with this church, which, you know, anybody asked me, I'd say this head pastor there is a very good preacher. He's apparently very humble and a good pastor. He helps out people that need counsel. And so it's not to say you're at fault. It's just to say there's some information that you might want to be aware of. Just as, you know, the apostles, not that I'm claiming to be one by any means, but you got Peter, Paul, John, James, directly speaking towards excesses and things to try to minimize in your relationship with God. So that would be one way to look at it. So at the same church, the pastor brought up the idea of increasing the quality of our prayer life. And so he told us about a book that he really thought was wonderful. It's by Pete Gregg, and it's called How to Pray, A Simple Guide for Normal People. And that was published in 2019. So Gregg has participated in Lateranish seminars that include the NAR affiliated Cindy Jacobs and others. Jacobs has said that there must be complete unity of evangelicals, charismatics, and Pentecostals. So my question would be, since she's NAR affiliated and kind of by way of secondary connection, she's being introduced to this church I'm attending. So who really gains and who suffers from this kind of unity? I don't think you can have unity at any cost and unity despite how you treat people, your doctrines, your practices, and so on. So the same head pastor later encouraged the congregation to do something we've never done before. He instructed us to engage in 24/7 prayer and to bathe the church with intercessory prayer. So is there anything wrong with the word choice of bathe and 24/7 prayer? Even though it's been borrowed from NAR advocates who facilitate NAR influence, or is there any problem with the assumptions implied by this new and improved form of more spiritually effective prayer?
You know, like I said, I started learning Christianity from square one whenever I left. And the idea of a better prayer is just so confusing to me. How do you pray better? And when I'm talking to you, I guess I could talk better and you could understand me better. But if God is supposed to be all understanding, can you really do that? I don't know that you can. There are Bible passages that says he knows our needs before we even ask them. He knows our prayer before we even pray. So if you're talking about a God who is almighty, who knows the inside of your heart before you even speak or bow your head, that's a God who doesn't really need you to pray better. That's a, the whole thing just doesn't make any sense to me. But what it does, where it does make sense, is if you have a strategy where you can give people a what's the word? In the IT world, we call it gamification. We gamify things and we make it more appealing, more exciting, because there's an achievement. If you unlock that achievement, then you go to the next achievement. This crazy Christian world has created the idea of gamifying prayer, where you can pray just slightly better and you unlock the achievement. You might become more spiritual. You unlock the next one. And it's just so wrong when you think about it. It tells people, you take somebody who's off the street, who loves God, who really just pours out their heart, and then come and listen to somebody who says, well, you don't really know how to pray, my brother. What does that, how does that make them feel? And I look at this, this whole thing is just wrong.
Yeah, it's wrong. And as you're speaking, it reminded me, I don't have chapter and verse on this, but, and I'm not really sure who said it. I think it might have been Jesus who said it, but he makes an example between two different people praying. And he says, one comes in very haughty and feels that they're superior. The other beats its chest and in humility says, have mercy on me, a sinner. And so, and then it says, who do you think was justified by their way of praying to God? So that, I think that's very, very telling. So, of course, non-affiliated apostles and prophets have consequences to what they say. So this was, again, something that the head pastor mentioned and didn't give a whole lot of detail. But he spoke very glowingly about a revival, so-called, that was associated with what God was doing at Asbury University. If I'm not mistaken, Asbury is considered a fairly normal theological school, not really affiliated with NAR or any other thing. But here was something I found out when I looked into Asbury University and any kind of revival. It so happens that Holly Pivick and Doug Givett, I think is his last name, they've written an excellent article that you can find online. It's called The NAR and the Asbury Revival, Why We Should Be Concerned. And that was written in 2023. So what do they tell us? They tell us that the NAR made a very strong showing at this so-called outpouring of the Spirit, and that it was supported by apostles, prophets, and NAR leaders who took to social media to promote the event, to promote the revival. So this article also focuses on three affiliated NAR, NAR-affiliated prophets. One, Lance Wallnall, who's fairly notorious in his comments and teachings. Chris Vallotton, who's, I believe he's with Bethel, which is also NAR. And this fellow again, James Gull. So the need for concern was due to the NAR's extreme position that, quote, apostles and prophets must govern the church, or else there cannot be true or lasting revival. So Holly and Doug are not looking to tear down the whole house. They believe that that you can be a charismatic, you can desire revival, but this kind of authoritarian way of seeing, if you want real revival and real prayer, then you better do it our way and be in submission to us. It also mentioned that a sermon was made by Alan Hood, the one I had mentioned earlier, and that the students at Asbury were exposed by him to the eschatological goals of the latter and influence mandate to, one, rise up and take dominion of society, two, expect a great end-time revival, and three, become part of the global church, rising up in miraculous power to usher in Christ's return. For Pivick and Gavette, the faith and allegiance of young and vulnerable Christians are in the process of being what they call hijacked by NAR prophets such as Dutch Sheets, Alan Hood, and the very notorious Lou Engel. According to them, what recently transpired at Asbury reflects, quote, the opportunistic impulse of NAR leaders who seek to gain visibility and further their NAR agenda to bring heaven to earth. So what the NAR leader Dutch Sheets said in his An Appeal to Heaven, that was 2015, figured prominently in Asbury's so-called Collegiate Day of Prayer. According to Pivak and Givet, Sheets also, through his Appeal to Heaven teachings, has been seen as one of the major factors fueling the riot at the Capitol.
And that's really the other problem that I have with this invasion or this virus, however you want to call it. The Latter Rain movement was heavily influenced by politics, and we've talked through some of the political history. So you had politics entering into the revival, and then the revival themes took on political themes. Well, now, years, decades later, this is coming into the churches, and it has, interestingly, some of the political themes from the 50s and 60s, but it's also hyper-focused on some of the current urgent political missions by some of the people. So you've got this mixing of revival and politics, and that blend together, it's really hard for me to call that Christianity.
So this final comment that I have is quite personal, and I thought it was very telling about influences that people in leadership in the NAR and can have, and not to go way into it, as you mentioned in politics, but there have been several people who've recently been in a position to testify about things that they experienced, which would be completely illegal, but due to fear of reprisals and any kind of negative results, have been sort of pushed to the side, or at least felt uneasy about getting involved in the comments that they wanted to say. Okay, so this more personal thing related to NAR incursions at this church, which says non-charismatic, denominational, and it goes like this. I made a lesson plan after speaking to the leader of the Sunday school class. And so we had it lined up right. I mean, as you know, John, a lesson on either this sort of stuff, even if you're toning it down and editing it quite a bit, you know, like 30-minute slots at Sunday school, I mean, it can easily go like four lessons through 4 weeks. And so I had those, and I had videos of other folks than myself. Had some videos by Holly, like 8-minute videos, and then discussion questions to go with them. So I really wasn't trying to toot my own horn, and I didn't have anything from me other than direct quotes of some of the NAR folks, and then again some discussion questions. So the leader said, yes, he was all into it. He said he really would enjoy that, and he listened to the videos and thought they were appropriate and not they weren't extreme or anything like that. And so he said, yeah, go for it, Steve. Okay, I don't know what happened in the meantime, but the fact that he not only said go for it, but he let me know that one of his daughters is in a NAR-affiliated church. And so he has a personal feeling about this. Okay, so I looked at this and thought that I think this could do some good. But whatever happened between our discussion of presenting these things and then getting to the moment of going ahead and teaching these lessons was that I was allotted only one 30-minute spot to cover the whole topic of why Christians should be aware of the NAR and its dangers. My only thought was that this was due to the feeling that it might be a little bit too controversial and alarm some of our newer members of the class.
Well, this has been fascinating, Steve. I know that I know it's a touchy subject for a lot of people, but interestingly, I get, you know, I'm looking through my email now at some people who are questioning, is this thing that we have in our church, is this new apostolic reformation invading our church? I get this from time to time, and it's really scary for people. I usually respond, I don't want to heighten the fears, you know, it is bad, and I really don't like the authoritarianism coming into the churches. What I usually respond is many of the mainstream churches, unless they get overtaken by the New Apostolic Reformation, ooh, there is a sort of structure that kind of prevents some of the bad things from happening in some of the denominational churches. So depending on the one that you're going to, it may or may not. I don't know each individual church structure, but I will say that some of them will not let an authoritarian leader come in. Otherwise, there are checks and balances that have to be in place to make sure that somebody isn't going to hijack and turn it into a cult. So not to raise the fears of people, but just the threads of this stuff making it into the churches and the names that you're mentioning, I can't believe a mainstream church would preach anything from IHOP KC or yeah, any of these people. So it's a little bit scary, but it's I think there are enough checks and balances that it makes it preventable of disaster. I'll just say it like that. Thank you so much for doing this.
You're very welcome, John. Hope to see you again sooner this time.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.